Sydney Institute tonight. Joe Hockey makes a welcome return. He was here a few years ago now, but it's great to have him back. And Joe's been a long time and most valued supporter and associate member of the Sydney Institute, so it's good to see Joe Hockey along here. I'll introduce him very briefly. He's been the member for North Sydney since 1996. Before that, he was a lawyer dealing in the financial services area. He was appointed to the ministry very early in his political career. He's in the ministry in 1998. And, of course, he currently holds one of the senior cabinet positions in the Howard government as Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations. And tonight, among the areas of his substantial portfolio, the Minister's going to speak for us on women and work. Joe Hockey, you're welcome.
Thank you very much, Jared. And ladies and gentlemen, very great pleasure to be here. And if we turned off the lights, I suspect we'd get a great view of my electorate in North Sydney. Australians face a stark choice when the next election rolls around. They can choose between a Labor Party that believes regulation, artificial rules, and centralised control can benefit the modern workplace, or they can choose an employment environment that fosters fairness, flexibility, and opportunity. An employment environment that gives workers, either individually or collectively, a genuine chance to sit down with their employer and nut out an agreement that suits everyone. It is this fundamental difference that will be at the heart of the fierce political debate over the coming months. Yesterday, I released a document that showed that the Federal Labor Party and state Labor governments, as well as the union bosses, have amassed a $100 million war chest to spend on the campaign. Their message is one of fear and pessimism, one where every worker is either a victim or a potential victim. They want to return to the old era of industrial relations, where union bosses were front and centre of every negotiation in an inflexible system. I believe that the Howard government's workplace relations system offers Australians the opportunity to compete with the rest of the world at a time when the world is changing. I believe our workplace relations system is an essential part of a strong economy and is the latest in a long line of hard economic decisions this government has been prepared to make. The changes we have made to workplace relations over the past 11 years have benefited all Australians. But tonight I would like to talk about one very important sector of the labour market, women. Women stand to gain the most from our changes and stand to lose the most from Labor's rigid ideas. It is women who require more workplace flexibility. Flexibility is a word that is bandied around a lot in the workplace relations debate, but it is the central theme of my speech tonight because it offers real, tangible benefits to women. The Howard government's workplace relations system is the only system that can offer women genuine flexibility. After good pay and job security, flexibility is the single most important thing to a working woman. This is not my opinion. This is what the Equal Opportunity for Women in the Workplace Agency has found within my portfolio. Women from North Sydney to Kalgoorlie have told us they want flexible working conditions, good pay and bonuses, job security, a career path, a workplace that genuinely supports work-life balance, the opportunity to work to their potential, learning and development, paid maternity leave, and active assistance with childcare. So in our workplaces, historically created by men for men, it is only since women have increased their workforce participation that an understanding of the need for flexibility has emerged. Importantly, women need managers, both men and women, who know how to manage a flexible workforce. Women need the ability to work part-time, have access to flexible start and finish times, job sharing, telecommuting, and the ability to purchase leave for things like extended school holidays. These are fair and reasonable conditions that form part of our modern workplace relations system. And when looking to the future of women in the workforce, it is also important to remember the past. It's particularly important at this point in time because it is the past where Kevin Rudd, Julia Gillard and the rest of the Labor Party are getting their ideas. Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard take their cues from a union movement that pays lip service to women's rights in the workforce. Yet the union movement has always struggled with even the most basic notions of flexibility, such as part-time work. Even now, Sharon Burrow doesn't like to talk about women working from home. Working from home is as far from Sharon Burrow's beloved centralised system as you can get. Indeed, a one-size-fits-all approach to workplace relations can often work against women. The OECD, not Joe Hockey, the OECD recently noted that prescriptive and punitive legislation such as the unfair dismissal laws hurt those most vulnerable in the workplace. In other words, small business owners are more likely to employ women and young people, particularly those who have been out of the workforce for a long period of time, when workplace relation laws remove unreasonable penalties and disincentives for employers. Therefore, employers are prepared to take more of a risk employing someone without a work history when there is no unfair dismissal law. Julia Gillard owes her political existence to the union movement. It is only natural that she'd find it difficult to understand that it is less regulation, not more, that is the key to women progressing in the workforce. The old system of inflexible, trade union-dominated workplaces worked against women. This is demonstrated by the ongoing decline in female union membership. In fact, in the last 12 months alone, 48,800 women have torn up their union membership forms. These latest figures continue the long-term trend of steadily declining union membership by women in this country. But Labor and the union bosses' stance goes much further than heavy-handed regulation. The very culture of victimisation they are trying to create is working against women. Labor's public scare campaign on jobs and childcare are discouraging women from returning to the workforce and realising their full potential. This discouragement comes at a time when the country and women can least afford it. Just last month, representatives from Childcare Queensland spoke publicly about the impact of scare campaigns and sensational reports on childcare shortages. The result, they say, is that parents are not even looking for childcare because of the bad publicity. These are parents, some parents, who want and need to work, giving up because of irresponsible scare campaigns. Senior management at Childcare Queensland have surveyed their members and found that there are many vacancies across the state. They say in most towns and cities throughout Queensland, there is a surplus of childcare vacancies. They acknowledge that these might not be right next door to where the family live or work, but they believe there will be vacancies within a reasonable distance. The vacancies aren't just in Queensland. My colleague Mal Brough, Minister for Family, Community Services and Indigenous Affairs, estimates that there are up to 120,000 childcare vacancies across Australia. Labor's doomsday predictions about the changes to workplace relations system are also unfounded. The same could be said about our welfare to work reforms, another policy opposed by the Labor Party. From the 1st of July, more than 200,000 single or partner mothers on a pension will have a work obligation, many for the first time. They will be required to work 15 hours a week when their youngest child reaches school age. We argue it is better for somebody to work than remain on welfare. Yet all we hear is scaremongering. Instead of stirring up scare campaigns, our government is actively supporting more women to enter the workforce and assisting those women already in the workforce. We are doing this through welfare to work. We're doing this through workplace relations reform. We are giving people what they want. We have set a framework that recognises women's requirements around flexibility that is genuine, legislatively based safety net of pay and conditions. And the numbers speak for themselves. Employment growth since 1996 has seen more than 1 million new jobs created and occupied for women and by women. The female participation rate in Australia has increased to a near record high of 57.5%. The unemployment rate is at a 32-year low, and since the commencement of work choices in March last year, 276,000 new jobs have been created nationally. 96% of those jobs are full-time, which is an amazing statistic. And of the 276,000 new jobs, 117,500 have been filled by women. Data from the OECD report Women and Men in OECD Countries show that Australia's gender wage gap is significantly below the OECD average and other similar countries such as the United Kingdom and the United States. Employers must value women equally in the form of pay, equal pay for work of equal value. Real wages for women have increased by 22.6% since we came to government in 1996, compared with 8.8% under 13 years of the Labor Party. Research from the Equal Opportunity for Women in the Workforce Agency and the Office for Women shows that 46% of medium to large organisations and 19% of small businesses provide paid maternity leave. Just repeat that. 46% of medium to large organisations are providing paid maternity leave. According to the Australian Bureau of Statistics annual survey released this month, 43.7% of women now have paid maternity leave entitlements, an increase from 30.3% 5 years ago. So from 30.3 to 43.7 in just 5 years. In 2005, 21% of businesses actively assisted their employees with childcare, including on-site care, sponsored places, financial assistance, emergency care placement, and other information. The government is also providing a record level of funding to help families cover the costs of childcare and other expenses. This financial year alone, the government will spend $28 billion assisting women and families through initiatives such as the baby bonus and family tax benefit. These statistics are just some of the proof that the Howard government's workplace relations system has delivered better pay and more jobs for women. Whilst the family benefits have delivered a responsible safety net for families, we have also delivered a workplace relations system that offers choice and flexibility. It is, however, business that must secure and embed within the organisation an attitude that provides greater security and support for women when they are balancing priorities. I call on business to do better. Business must act quickly to introduce greater flexibility in workplaces. In a report titled Better Conditions, Better Business, recently launched by my colleague Julie Bishop, it was no surprise that businesses that are predominantly operated by females were more likely to offer carer and family-friendly provisions to their employees. So the good news is that some women are getting what they want. I was pleased to see the benefits of our system at work when I met a female crane operator at a nickel smelter in Kalgoorlie. Yeah, she's on an individual agreement with family-friendly conditions. BHP Billiton told me they have a shift pattern which involves 2 day shifts, 2 night shifts, and then 4 days off. This arrangement provides significant benefits to those people with families. BHP noted around 18% of staff are female. This is at a nickel smelter. And that they are looking at offering shifts during school hours and expanding the availability of job sharing. I'm also advised that women using heavy industrial equipment tend to take better care of the machines. So for employers, it's a win-win. I might add, when I went down the road to the super pit, I found that those massive Cat trucks were also being driven by women. And when I met the chief mechanic of the site, he said, "Mate, I'd put a Sheila behind the wheel any day of these things." He said, "They take better care of them." There you go. Job sharing and shift sharing are far easier to achieve when you can enter into negotiations directly with your employer. This is particularly important for female workers, and particularly female workers coming back into the workforce when they've had children. Acumen Alliance, a business and IT consulting practice, has set a new benchmark for organisations aspiring to provide truly flexible workplaces. Its chief executive, Robert Kennedy, has rejected the current dichotomy that work and life are two separate concepts. Acumen gives employees total authority and flexibility to determine their working patterns and sets no limit on the amount of unpaid leave. As a result, they've created a workplace where flexibility is available to everyone in the organisation, from the receptionist to the chief executive officer. Any changes to working patterns are pre-approved by the executive. All staff are able to choose permanent full-time, part-time, or contract arrangements. If there's a silver bullet to greater workforce participation by women, it is a concerted effort on job design at every level and in every role. History has shown that looking for new ways to approach work will increase productivity through efficiencies, save lives through occupational health and safety advances, and create new industries. Appropriate job design is about ensuring that realistic workloads, goals, and outcomes can be achieved. I'm bemused when I hear stories about women who return to work part-time after maternity leave and end up putting in full-time hours. They do this because the job has not been properly redesigned in many cases. The mother is getting on the computer late at night after the baby is fed and in bed to get the job done. Some might say that being able to work from home like that is flexibility, but not when you are only getting paid for the 3 days a week you're actually in the office. Women's workforce participation increases with the age of the child. This means the talented female worker with corporate knowledge and experience is more than likely going to return to the workforce. Worst case scenario, to a direct competitor. And in law firms, I might add, often they go off and become corporate lawyers because the hours and the working conditions are far more flexible and far more generous than what can be very difficult working environments in big law firms. And I am mindful I'm standing at Mallison Stevens James, so forgive me. Job design is linked to increasing workforce participation, particularly that of women, because it can dramatically expand the pool from which workers can be drawn. A few years ago, Coca-Cola attracted more women into their sales team by removing a requirement to lift heavy cases of drink as part of the day-to-day job. It was recognised that this component of the job favoured males and that strength was not an appropriate merit-based selection criteria for a successful salesperson. It excluded potentially talented female salespeople who could ultimately increase profits from the opportunity to work in the field. Another way employers are better able to redesign the workplace is through technology. American journalist Thomas Friedman, who will deliver the Sydney Institute lecture next month, describes in his landmark missive, The World is Flat, how some American companies are successfully using technology to enable women to work from home. Friedman describes how low-cost airline JetBlue has 400 women working at home in Salt Lake City, where the vast majority of women are Mormons and many are stay-at-home mums. These women are taking reservations in between looking after the kids, exercising, writing novels and cooking dinner. JetBlue found that the women who worked from home were 30% more productive and more loyal. They worked on average 25 hours a week and had to come into the head office for 4 hours a month to learn new skills and keep up with what was going inside the company. These are women who are getting the flexibility they want, thanks to an employer prepared to embrace new practices and new technology. Ideas such as flexibility and modern job design are admirable, but they cannot be fully realised unless they exist within a healthy macroeconomic environment. No part of the economy is disconnected from another, and the labour market is no exception. The Howard government has consistently delivered a strong economic foundation for Australian women and their families. This strong economic foundation has helped business to create jobs. And I am very mindful that it is business that creates jobs and not government. Our flexible workplace relations system is the key to meeting the challenges of the modern workplace. In Australia, in 2007, if you have the capacity to work, Australia needs you to work. The intergenerational report released by the Treasurer earlier this month projects the average hours worked to decline gradually over the next 40 years. One of a number of trends likely to affect economic growth and long-term financial sustainability. Reforms to lift the population, participation and productivity, such as the baby bonus, welfare to work and work choices, are critical to ensuring our country's growth prospects. We will only meet the challenges of our worker shortage and ageing population if female participation remains high, and the key to female participation is flexible working arrangements. We can't afford to go backwards. For a brief moment, I'd like to take you back to the Hawke Keating years and the 1990 recession we had to have, the worst recession in 60 years. They were dark days. We inherited a federal budget deficit of $10.1 billion in 1995-96. Interest rates averaging during the term of the Hawke Keating government, interest rates averaging more than 12%, peaking at 17%, and unemployment hitting 11%, with nearly 1 million people unemployed. Many businesses were forced to sack workers. Others negotiated pay cuts in an attempt to prevent businesses from collapsing. Despite endless industrial regulation and protection under Labor, almost 1 million Australians found themselves without a job. I emphasise that no government can legislate to keep people in work. No government. And it failed in the early 1990s. Most people at that time knew a close friend or family member who was made redundant. People's homes were sold from underneath them. There is an entire generation who will vote at the next federal election that does not know or remember these times of despair. Despite the challenges we have faced as a nation over the last decade, such as the Asian economic crisis, when 7 out of our top 10 trading partners were in recession or depression, SARS, September 11th, the war against terrorism and the worst drought in 100 years, our economic success as a country during this period is almost unparalleled. And the figures speak for themselves. Australia's modern workplace system enshrines equal pay for equal work. It enshrines the federal minimum wage and classification wages, all 105,000 of them. It provides for 12 months unpaid parental leave for all working parents, including eligible casuals, and enshrines a pursuit of flexibility in the workplace. The World Economic Forum's latest Global Gender Gap Report 2006 described Australia as a leader in closing the gender gap. Australia is to be congratulated for completely closing the gender gap in education. According to the report, Australia is only one of 12 countries out of 115 to have achieved parity. We have reason to be pleased about that aspect, but no reason to be complacent. Even though 120 years ago, women were admitted to all higher education degrees, it took a further 100 years for women to constitute half of the students attending university. In 2001, I said Australia is a nation of smart people, not just smart men. 6 years have passed, and still women are underrepresented in leadership positions, within the engine room of our economy, in business. The 2006 Census of Women in Leadership, conducted by the Equal Opportunity for Women in the Workplace Agency, in conjunction with ANZ and Macquarie University, shows that in the ASX 200, only 12% of executive positions are held by women. The result of education parity spurs me on to close the gender gap in other areas. As Minister for Jobs, I have a specific role to play in closing the gender gap in the economy, which means increased participation levels, improved outcomes on pay and flexibility, and greater access to high-skilled employment. It is deregulation, not more regulation, that will make this happen. It is flexibility in the workplace, not a rigid, centralised system, that will help close the gap. Despite great efforts to encourage more women to enter the workforce, and the assistance being provided to women already in the workforce, there is still more to be done. The Howard government's workplace relations system will ensure continued progress and improvements for women in the workforce that benefit women, their families, business and the economy. The role of women as mums is significant in our society, in the lives of the women themselves, their partners and their children. As a society, we need to do better at valuing and supporting the choices women make around their roles as mums. We need to ensure that women do have real choices, and women who seek to participate in the paid workforce, regardless of their life stage, are not discriminated against and can achieve their greatest potential. As a modern nation, we should expect nothing less. I'm very proud of the fact that Australia is a world leader in closing the gender gap, and that on my watch, our workplace relations system is positively contributing to this achievement by providing greater flexibility and choice for women and their employers. Tonight, I urge business to look beyond the old paradigm of full-time work, to look beyond the culture of long hours, and to look beyond the men in the white and blue collars. Business needs to harness the opportunity of innovative work organisation and job design, focus on the potential benefits and value women for the real and talented contribution they are making today and can make into the future. Thank you.
Many thanks. As we come to question and discussion time, before we do, I should say thanks to Mellisons for the use of this facility this evening. And so we come to question and discussion time. Can I ask you just a question about the broad portfolio of the industrial relations side of it? I mean, as you've said tonight, there is enormous flexibility in the system now, and it has benefited women, and it has benefited young people, and it has benefited people who are having trouble getting jobs. But why is it needed to have such a lengthy Industrial Relations Act of such regulatory magnitude in order to bring about a situation of less regulation or deregulation?
Well, when you're consolidating 4,000 awards with 105,000 classifications and six different systems, nothing's simple. And that's what it is. Every state apart from Victoria has its own law, its own Industrial Relations Commission, its own Minister for Industrial Relations, and state awards and federal awards. And then again, you add in the fact that there are collective agreements and have been enterprise agreements around for a number of years. And furthermore, Australian workplace agreements have been around since 1996. I mean, if you believe the hype, you would think that AWA's sort of fell from the sky in March of last year. But in fact, they've been around since 1996. The world didn't come to an end. And what we've introduced is greater flexibility. And the Labor Party want to tear up not just work choices, but they want to go back and tear up the 1996 legislation. There's a microphone there too, if you want to put a microphone.
I agree with you about flexibility in women working, but one of the set of figures that have been thrown around in the last few weeks by your opponents has been that in the time of the new industrial relations policy has been operating, women's share of the take-home pay has dropped. Now, this is some kind of statistical average, but can you explain that?
Well, in fact, real wages have increased by 1.5% overall. Real wages have been flat, in particular for women. The reason is that what we've seen is the retail and hospitality industries, where there is an overwhelming majority of women. You just look at any Coles or Woolies supermarket chain or Myers or any other place, and that industry, retail in particular, has been very flat. And that they have also embraced AWOs. So the result is... that wages have been down in those sectors because they've been less profitable. The mining industry has been incredibly profitable, as has the construction industry, where they are male-dominated industries. And the ABS methodology doesn't take that into account on a sectoral basis. It is a source of quite significant frustration to me. My overwhelming concern is and remains equal pay for equal work. And when I hear, and the law protects all parties in that regard, and the discrimination laws continue to apply, and I've asked the Office of Workplace Services to keenly follow up on those areas where discrimination might be evident.
Bill Conway, Mr. Hawking. I remember about 20 years ago, we had something that was called flexi time, which sort of gave both men and women the opportunity to work their particular, to suit their particular situations. And there was also a 38-hour week at that time.
Yeah.
Now, I wonder how, right now, I understand that the average person works more like 50 hours, but getting paid for 38. And the flexibility, I just wonder how your flexibility is going to be any better than flexing time.
Yeah. Okay. Well, firstly, the average working week has reduced in time over the last 12 months. And in fact, I haven't got the figures immediately available, but it appears that we are following the longer-term trend that we are working, believe it or not, less hours than previously. And the second thing is that, and I'm happy to supply you independently with that data from the ABS. Secondly, in fact, I can tell you, in the 12 months since the introduction of work choices, the working week on average has dropped 30 minutes, whatever that word, whatever it means. Secondly, the minimum standards in our work choices legislation state that there will be a 38-hour week plus reasonable overtime. Thirdly, what happened was the mainstream industrial relations system was so rigid and inflexible for so long that there was a flight of people to casual labour and a flight of people to become independent contractors because they found that the mainstream system was not flexible enough to accommodate their needs. And that's particularly the case in retail and hospitality, where I've met people who have been casually employed for 13 years because the mainstream system was not flexible enough to accommodate the needs of, for example, the hospitality industry. A hotel in Port Macquarie, 45 staff, all of them were employed as casuals, some for 13 years. And so what happened was they never had any job security. They couldn't go down the bank to borrow money because they didn't have a piece of paper. And I met women in particular who were working in that industry at that hotel who for the first time got an AWA, a contract, and could walk down to the bank and borrow money, which they couldn't do previously. They were paid the same amount of money as they were under casual employment, but they were not part of the mainstream system. And what our laws have done is to bring all that casualisation of the, not all of it, a lot of it, casualisation of the workforce into the mainstream industrial system to provide protection for independent contractors and, importantly, at the same time, to offer some job security for those people that previously didn't have it.
How does our industrial relation philosophy or rules or regulation or regulations compare to other countries? Did you develop the philosophy internally yourself here in Australia, or did you take a leaf out of the book from other countries?
The industrial relations reform has been common to a number of countries over a number of years. I mean, New Zealand is the most obvious example. It introduced individual contracts or AWA equivalents well before Australia. The United States has certainly got a more deregulated industrial relations system than Australia in many areas. I mean, there's no one-size-fits-all model. I remember anyone who has read any of Tony Blair's early speeches. Margaret Thatcher deregulated the British industrial relations system very early on, and Tony Blair stood before the union movement and when he first became Prime Minister and said, I'm not changing the system. And why? Because it is front and centre of the economic growth of Britain. And you can see, anyone that walks through London today can see the benefits of a fair and open system and the economic wealth that it has helped to create. So our system is not particularly unique. It certainly doesn't go as far as some other countries. It's certainly less regulated than some European countries. I just make this point. I mean, you know, as Thomas Friedman, and I'm really looking forward to listening to Thomas Friedman. I hold him in very high regard when he comes to speak to Sydney Institute. As he has pointed out, the world is changing dramatically. And the best evidence of that is there's a perception that that somehow all these manufacturing jobs in Australia are going to China. But in fact, between 1995 and I think it was 2002, China lost 15 million manufacturing jobs to other countries. Very interesting statistic. And that comes out of a global economic report. And the reason why is because China is competing with everyone else and it's upgrading its skills. So it might be a sporting shoe manufacturing used to be done in China, but now China wants to be the designer of those shoes, and they moved the factory to Laos or Cambodia or Vietnam, wherever the case might be, where they can produce them at a cheaper unit cost than China. And we saw Japan and Germany undertake that sort of change in the post-war period. But what happened was Japan and Germany stopped when it came to industrial relations reform. And their economies ground to a bit of a structural halt. In fact, in the case of Japan, they went backwards. And why? Because the view in Japan was everyone had to have be a part of this very strict industrial relations environment. Germany is still carrying their very heavy weight of a long history of socialism. And that in the end, if you don't keep changing, if you don't embrace modern technology and modern flexibility, you pay the price.
There's a question here, and then we'll go over there.
Minister, you pointedly referred to the $100 million war chest that the forces of darkness have got amassed against the federal government. Can you tell us how much is in your war chest to send a message out to the electorate in relation to these laws and why they are good and worth voting for when the time comes? And is it your expectation that the government's message is going to be assisted by advertising by the small business groups and big business in support of this legislation?
Well, I would hope that anyone who believes in these laws and their contribution to the strength of the economy would back it up in workplaces. The reason why I highlighted the $100 million, it's not all from the unions. The state governments are spending $12 million of your money running some examples of what have been shown to be inappropriate inquiries. They've employed people to become work choices monitors, even though the state governments at any time can claim back the referred power from the Commonwealth to back to the states. They're still running political campaigns every day. I don't know how many insightful academic analyses we're going to see between now and the election from hired guns by the state and Labor governments, but I assume it'll be quite a few. Now, the challenge for us is to clearly indicate to the Australian people that it's no accident that the economy is strong. And it comes about hard decisions. And look, you know, I mean, the hardest election I've fought was 1998, when we went to the election promising to introduce a new tax. And, you know, I tell you, I wouldn't be rushing to do that again. Right? That was the hardest election. And I felt this inherent, this inherent belief that if I couldn't convince the Australian people or the people in North Sydney, my own electorate, that what we were doing was in the national interest as opposed to our own political interest, then, well, maybe I didn't want to be in federal politics. And there was an enormous sense of relief when we won that election, because I felt the Australian people had got it right, that we had the guts to say we are going to introduce a new tax system. This is how we're going to do it. And we did it, and it was good for Australia, and it helped us through difficult days. And the courage someone like Peter Reith had in reforming the waterfront. People said it was too hard. 17 crane movements an hour before there was reform of the waterfront. Now it's 27 movements an hour. You know? I mean, 10 years ago, it took 5 hours to produce, on average, a service in Australia. Today it takes 4 hours. And these are hard reforms. That's why I want to be in government, to make those hard decisions. And work choices is a hard decision. And industrial relations reform is damn hard. But if you feel that you are there to make a difference for the country with the appropriate safety net, then hopefully that conviction will come through in the message that you send to the Australian people.
So how do you read those opinion polls on work choices?
Oh, I think the unions have run an incredible scare campaign. I mean, I just could not believe that the New South Wales Nurses Federation spent $1.7 million of their members' money campaigning against federal laws in a state election when the New South Wales nurses are not even covered by federal law. And the Victorian nurses are covered by federal law and they didn't campaign. And I just thought, God, yeah, I mean, if, you know, I reckon nurses work incredibly hard. I think they work extraordinary hours, as so many people do. And they should be properly rewarded for it. But the current industrial relations system run by the states hasn't helped them. I mean, the more regulation they have and the more they, you know, rely on state government largesse, it hasn't helped the nurses to get better pay and more reward. And the nurses, in many cases, go into the private sector or leave the nursing profession in pursuit of better conditions, usually. I mean, you know, a lot of them like good money, but I mean, I've always found the nurses I know are not particularly motivated by money. They've got much higher ideals, and I respect them for it. But, you know, the state system has not been their great friend.
New South Wales teachers also aren't covered by the work choices legislation, and that's a profession that is dominated by women. And yet your colleague, Julie Bishop, seems to want to introduce into that salary uncertainty in a profession that's not particularly well paid in any case.
Yeah.
Salary uncertainty, and she wants to do it on the basis of merit, without any clear policy of how she wants to assess merit. How does that fit with your policy of trying to encourage more women into the workforce?
Mm. Well, in fact, she has released a paper which she was discussing with the state ministers, to have an assessment of merit based on the contribution of the principal of the school, based on the performance of the children, based on feedback from parents and a range of other groups. So there was a methodology that she outlined. The challenge is that the state school system is in competition with the private school system, and the private school system is moving towards payment on merit and performance. And I don't think state teachers should be left behind. I think there are a lot of very good state public school teachers. And I think they should be properly rewarded for excellence.
But you would need more money.
Just to finish, you know what, if there is merit-based performance, everyone wins. I mean, I couldn't believe, I had one of my old school teachers from a private school come and see me and say, isn't it outrageous that, you know, teachers will be paid different levels of salary. I said, you mean they're not paid different levels of salary at that school? I went to it. And he said, oh, no, you know, we don't want merit-based performance. I said, for God's sake, people are paying thousands of dollars to send their children to your school. I know families where both parents are working to send them to your school, and they have to work hard and they compete in a merit-based environment to earn the money to send them to your school, and you don't want to be assessed on merit? Give us a break, mate. And, you know, he went back and reported that I was, you know... I got a phone call from the Jesuit father and he counselled me about things.
More time in purgatory.
More time in purgatory. I always say when I go, you know, on the odd occasions I go to confession, it used to be, forgive me, Father, for I have sinned, how long have you got?
Just wanted to pick up on the point you made that the Labor Party and the unions have run a very effective campaign against work choices. Now, and so a lot of disgraceful things in my view, things that can't really be backed up. But it seems to me that the government hasn't been terribly effective to date in refuting all that. I mean, we've listened to your discussion today, and it's to do with facts and figures and numbers and so on, all good stuff, but the average person hasn't got time for all that.
Yeah.
So there must be a more effective way to get the good news out, surely, to counter this.
We're certainly looking at it. I can tell you, it's far easier to spread a climate of fear and pessimism and to turn everyone into a victim or potential victim than it is to sing the praises of people like a plumber in Townsville that I met, who said he went to his boss and could work every second Saturday for 4 hours, taking his kid around in the truck. And the trade-off was that he could get home every afternoon to pick up his kids from school. And he said, previously, you would have had to pay me penalties under that arrangement. And you couldn't contract out of those penalty arrangements. So I had to stay here until 4 o'clock and never got to pick up my kid from school or go to school sport. Or the lawnmower guy at a sugar mill south of Cairns. He said, you know, my wife's in the tourism industry, I want to spend more time at home with my family. I cut the grass. Can you let me start working at 5 o'clock in the morning, cutting the grass at the sugar mill? And the guy said, look, I don't mind when you cut the lawn. I know whether it's cut or not. You can do it any hour. But previously he had to pay penalties if he started too early. And by law, he had to honour those penalties. But now he's on AWA, and they're flexible enough, and he gets his pay, and he can get home to see his family. And I mean, these are enriching and empowering stories that I have said time and time again in Parliament that never get repeated because good news doesn't sell newspapers. And it's frustrating because there are lots of people out there. Let me just be clear. By the time of the next election, 1 million Australians will be on current active AWAs. And another million Australians will be on union collective agreements or non-union collective agreements negotiated under work choices legislation. So there have been trade-offs. Now, I don't have any particular personal problem with the union movement, but I do note that the union bosses now represent 15% of the private sector workforce, only 1 in 5 workers, and it's falling. And that's fine, but I don't think the union bosses should be front and centre of every negotiation.
Minister, you haven't mentioned older workers. Is the fact that we're going to be working less hours in the future on account of the fact that we'll be working during our 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s?
And beyond. And beyond. In fact, I heard a great stat the other day. 1 in 3 little girls born today will live to 100. It's quite sobering, isn't it? And it's sobering because that's where workplace flexibility is essential. That's right. So my newborn daughter, I've already had a long chat to her about how long she's going to work. I mean, this is flexibility does matter, and particularly for older Australians. The best friend of working Australians as they age will be technology. It really will. I mean, and that's what's empowered, for example, women at that nickel smelter in Kalgoorlie, or the super pit in Kalgoorlie, or the umpteen other mines I've been to. They can drive this equipment. To think that a mine, 18% of the workers at a mine, or the Kalgoorlie super pit, which is one of the biggest open pit mines in the world, nearly 30% of the workers are women. It would have been unthinkable 10, 15, 20 years ago. But technology has been their best friend, and there aren't a lot of people there putting on the suits and, you know, going out there with a jackhammer or a kangaroo and cutting into the rock. So technology is the best friend of the ageing population in Australia. And it also is a case of flexibility as part of the equation, where you have the capacity to engage with customers, and customers may not know and probably won't care how old you are or where you're based. The interesting thing is you supply a service or a product that the customer wants. And if I can touch on technology for a second, Australia's laboured under this great weight of its distance from the rest of the world for all of our history. And I've said this before, even at the Sydney Institute, I think, that our greatest barrier to growth over the long term has been our distance from the rest of the world. Today, 70% of Australia's economy is services. You know, mining and agriculture represent maximum 15%. Services are 70% of our economy. We are in the time zone of the fastest growing region in the world, and distance for the first time is no barrier to economic growth. It's a great story and a great opportunity, and therefore we should embrace new technology and maximum flexibility. We should not have a strict retirement age. We should only rely on people's capacities rather than their age or the colour of their skin or anything else for that matter.
Minister, you talked about the low participation rates of women at the senior levels of the top 200 corporates in Australia. I think 12% was the figure you mentioned. I think it's even much worse for women on the boards of those same companies. I have no doubt that job design plays a critical factor in that low participation rate, and that things really won't change for women until women are in a lot of positions of authority. The only other job that I can think of that's worse designed than senior corporate Australia is federal parliament.
Yeah, I knew this was coming. As soon as I put it in the speech, I knew I'd get this.
And in terms of job design and flexibility, etc., I have no doubt that it's also there affecting the number of women participating in, let's call it cabinet, even the worst jobs in the country. Any thought on trying to tackle that?
Yes and no. Yes, in that, look, you know, you can have, and there's a good argument for greater workplace flexibility in federal politics. And in a bipartisan way, a number of people have raised that. For example, Parliament used to sit until 11 o'clock every night. That's gone out the door, thankfully, and you've got more family-friendly hours. It is still a tradition of the Parliament that you have to be there to vote. Some people have said, well, if you could vote remotely, that would be a good thing. Look, you know, as for being in Cabinet and being in the Ministry, it's very hard to be a minister or a minister for the whole country. I mean, here I am, a non-sitting week. This is my only day in Sydney. And, you know, next 2 days are Melbourne, day after Canberra and so on. Next week, a non-sitting week, the same, except somewhere else. I don't even know where. But, you know, and that's because if you go to, even though I'm based in North Sydney, you have to go to Tasmania because they say, well, we never see the Minister for Workplace Relations. And can you believe every town says that? And every, you know, and they're all God's country too. Because they say, this is God's country, isn't it? I say, yeah, sure, it's God's country. So it is it's a diverse and interesting country. It's a great privilege to be in federal parliament. It's an incredible privilege to be a minister in the government. And it's certainly not something that you spend your entire career in. And sometimes you've got to realise that's the case. I mean, if you were playing cricket for Australia, you'd realise that your career is not going to go for all your life. And to be in politics, you've got to realise that it's not a career for life. That's one of the challenges.
Thank you.
Just a final question on the employment part of your portfolio. I mean, as you appreciate travelling around Australia, as you do, we must be pretty close in many parts of Australia to full employment. So how are you going to fulfil the demand for labour when there's not much available labour around?
That's a good question, Jared. It is, I think, one of our most significant reforms, but it's not recognised. We are facing over the next 40 years a massive labour shortage in Australia, with an ageing population, increasing demand for taxpayer funds for health in particular and aged care. We're not reproducing ourselves, even though we are one of the few Western nations to have actually increased our birth rate. It's still not a replacement rate, and it is a massive challenge. Peter Costello's intergenerational report is compelling reading in that regard. There's two places you can get the workers. The first is to massively increase immigration. And I'm not just talking about going from, what is it, 140,000 now. I'm not saying just going 200,000. You would need to massively increase it in order to get close to replacement rate. And that is simply not sustainable, and it's not Australians won't accept that massive increase. The alternate is we have to touch into the pool of people who are on welfare who are of working age. Now, there's about 2.4 million Australians of working age on welfare. 2.4 million Australians of working age on welfare. That is about 500,000 on the dole, about 900,000 on parental pensions, and about 700,000 on a disability pension. That was growing at around 70,000 a year and so on. Youth allowance and so on. So now, of course, of those 2.4 million, say 400,000 are profoundly disabled and don't have the capacity to work. That leaves a pool of 2 million people who have the capacity to work but are not working. This government had the courage, after the last election, to introduce welfare to work. We created mutual obligation way back with the creation of Work for the Dole, but we have taken some hard yards on welfare to work. And as I pointed out in my speech, on the 1st of July, 233,000 people on parental pension, when their youngest child reaches school age, they'll have an obligation to work 15 hours a week. I make no apologies for that. We are running out of workers in Australia. We have also been increasing the test for people applying for the disability pension over the last 12 months. We have committed $3.7 billion to welfare to work. The best form of welfare, in my view, is the opportunity to have a job if you have the capacity to work. The Labor Party has opposed this all the way. And you know what the irony is? Bill Clinton in the United States went way further than we have gone. And Bill Clinton and the Democrats in the United States have praised it as a remarkable success. This is fundamental. This is fundamental to this, to our economic sustainability.
Now, it's been 7 o'clock. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you.
I know some people want to continue, but it's 7 o'clock and it's time. Joe hasn't been in the job very long, but I've been very impressed the way he's handled it. We've seen it tonight. It's a difficult portfolio. It's not popular legislation, and the only way you can get a message across is by telling personal stories, which the Minister did tonight. So many thanks for coming back to the Sydney Institute. Interesting that you quoted Tom Friedman. You'll be meeting Tom in a couple of weeks' time at the Sydney Institute. So thanks for coming back tonight. We're sure you'll be back again in the future, but for tonight, well done. Thank you.